Good morning to you. It's 10 minutes past the hour. That'd be past 8 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone, and David Allen Punt is with us. Also joining us now from Garden View, Texas, Dr. Don Clark. Don, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's a Monday post-Super Bowl here, and it's like a whole new era. And it's kind of a bummer because, for me anyway, there's no sports at all until baseball kicks up. This is
you have a little wait to go.
Dry time of the year is what it is. But that's okay. I'll survive it. Looking forward to our conversation today. And Lord of the Starfields brings it all to mind. Last week when you were with us, we talked about think of it as a dichotomy, almost a war, science versus faith. I don't know that that needs to be that way. I don't know that it should naturally fall that way, but we tend to dramatize conflicts, and I guess that's our way of doing that. But I do have to ask the question. Science is awfully good at investigating and discovering and explaining stuff. But everything I hear from science, I tend to categorize as a how things are done and not a why things are done. And yet, I'm thinking that science might take exception to that comment. Your thoughts, does science, is it capable of explaining the whys or just the hows?
Well, it depends on what you mean, you know, by why. I hate to start off that way, but
well, no, that's good.
Let's take an example. You know, if you say, "Why did this rock fall from the sky?" The question could be, "How did the rock fall from the sky?" And well, gravity pulled it, you know, pulled it from the air, and it came to the earth, but. Why did it? It's because the man in the airplane threw the rock out of the plane.
Uh-huh.
So science can answer that question, but if you're really talking about a theological or a philosophical, you know, question as to why is man here, science has absolutely no tools to be able to answer that question.
Well, see, in searching for the real why to your little example there, I would ask, why did the man throw the rock out of the airplane? But now we start to zero in on the reason why that rock hit the ground when in the manner it did.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we can't understand necessarily unless we ask the man why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, science won't be able to answer that unless, obviously, they interview him.
But there's a difference, I think, in describing how gravity worked to pull that rock down toward the center of the Earth and how it was put in that position and for what purpose. And maybe that's the difference between how and why. Why implies a purpose, at least the way I'm using it there. And
yes, that's correct.
That's got to be awfully difficult for science to detect in any sense of the word purpose.
Yes, I mean, it's science can, you know, we can look around and observe things and try to figure out, you know, how things are put together or, you know, various things like that. But it's very difficult to ascertain, as I said earlier, you know, why, for example, why is the Earth where it is? Why is the Sun where it is? Why is the Earth revolving around the Sun? We know that it revolves around the Sun. We know how fast the Earth is revolving around the Sun. We know that the Sun is, you know, in the Milky Way galaxy and where we're positioned in the Milky Way galaxy. But why is it that is the question.
But is it logic? Does pure logic suggest to us that there is a purpose in that? Or does pure logic say, I have no way of knowing that?
Yeah, I think pure logic would say I have no way of knowing.
Okay.
As opposed to say, well, let's suppose that it's this way because it has to be, because obviously there is life on Earth. And the Earth has to be a certain distance from the Sun, and the Sun needs to be in the position in the galaxy because there's life on Earth, and if all those things, you know, work together, then you have life on Earth. If they don't, then you don't have life on Earth.
Let's take this down to the question of evolution then. Would it be possible if we could sit down with science, and I don't really believe that you can sit down with science, but with that approach to thought, could we dissuade them from the theory of evolution using logic alone? Or does logic is logic incapable of answering why? I mean, do you have to step beyond that with something? That is it then, is that where science turns into philosophy?
Yes, it's you get into the metaphysical, you get into philosophy. You know, I think it's the question of origin. You see, as we were talking last week, if you exclude anything from out of our system, that is out of the box, as we were discussing last time, and you exclude a creator or a designer that is outside of this space-time continuum that we're in, then you have to come up with some type of explanation as to how we got here. And right now, the most popular one is evolution. Now, evolution, as defined by Darwin, has changed from the point of view our understanding of it, because evolution, from Darwin's point of view, is a slow, continuous process. But theories since that time have said, well, these things just seem to appear all at once, and so now we're going to change our theory and say punctuated evolution, because we've got these times in history where it looks like these type of animals showed up or these type of crustaceans showed up. So they're always changing the theory to try to match new findings, new observations.
That is the scientific process, isn't it? Theories get changed based upon new findings. And are you referring to the Cretaceous period when all kinds of life forms just appeared at once, according to what we might call the fossil record?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, if you look at the geological column, that's a discussion in itself.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
The geological column is correct.
We'll get there sooner or later.
Yeah, exactly. But if you have layers of Earth in this case, and you see, there's no crustaceans below this line, and then you have a well-defined line, and then you've got all kinds of different types of crustaceans after that, one would say it appeared in the time frame very quickly. So something must have happened in evolution to stimulate a rapid change. Now, that's what the new the punctuated evolution theory is all about. They don't explain what that thing was that caused this burst in diversity. They just say it happened because this is what we see.
But they're honest enough to say we don't know why.
Most of the time.
I'm thinking now of Mount St. Helens, and I know that Ian Taylor addressed this. In fact, as I recall, when I was talking to him on the air a few years ago, we talked about the rapid change in the area around Mount St. Helens, when scientists predicted it would take generations and generations to get back to anything like what it was before the eruption of the volcano. And yet, it happened much more rapidly than anyone expected, did it not?
Yes, because it's, again, you're looking at kind of two different theories. I mean, it's like the Grand Canyon. Okay, did the Grand Canyon form from the Colorado River over, a long period of time, or did it form very rapidly as a result of the flood? And, of course, those of us on the creation science side would say it happened rapidly. And so there's no... we don't have a problem with things appearing quickly. And, God created this earth to kind of regenerate itself. And so to see, trees and new growth and animals moving back into the area, to see trees vertically, standing upright in different layers, by the way, of mud in the bottom of the lake that was caught the brunt of all of the mudslide that came off the mountain after the eruption exploded, to see those trees standing upright and beginning to petrify does not surprise does not surprise me, mm-hmm. but it would surprise someone who has a slow time frame for, you know, their geology.
And geologists have seen that too, I think, in many other examples where things have progressed rather rapidly compared to what the expectations had been. So there are such things as cataclysmic changes that can happen over the course of a few days, a few years, a generation or two.
Yes, correct. There's a canyon actually in the Mount St. Helens area that's about 100, as I recall, it's about 160 feet high that formed within a minute. And it was, you took all the dust and everything from the volcano, and then when the mudslide came down the mountain, it formed this canyon, this huge canyon, in a very short period of time. So it's a, Mount St. Helens is a very good model for looking at the Grand Canyon, because if you take, you know, that obviously was a catastrophe. We know it was a catastrophe. And if you take that same geology and you transfer it to a much larger scale at the Grand Canyon, you just say, well, gee, this must have been a catastrophe as well.
Mm-hmm. Now they're talking about caldera is the word I was looking for here in Yellowstone Park. And there's evidence that that has erupted in the past and created huge differences. In fact, I've heard at least one program, and this is probably on public TV at one point, saw a program that said it may have eliminated as much as 90% of the human life on Earth at one point, with 10% surviving and then regenerating to where we are today. Are we looking at changes maybe there or elsewhere on Earth that pose similar questions to us? How threatened are we these days? How close to the end, so to speak?
Of course, from a theological point of view, is how close to the end is when is Jesus coming back?
Yeah.
From a physical point of view, I mean, there is no major evidence that something catastrophic is going to happen to the Earth, or a meteorite is going to crash into the Earth and destroy a third of the Earth. But certainly from Revelation, we know that a third of the Earth is going to burn up at some point in time. So I don't know if we can.
Does global warming fall into this category? What is your thought on this issue of global warming? Is it scientifically with foundation or without?
I think it is. The Earth has warmed a little bit, but the Earth goes through cycles of warming and cooling. What is being proclaimed? It's a political issue, really. The global warming. It's if you look at it from scientifically, the atmosphere, the temperature of the Earth changes with the activity of in the sun. So the more sunspots you get, the more energy you get being poured out to the Earth, the warmer the Earth gets. That by far surpasses anything that man has done to the atmosphere to cause any type of temperature change or fluctuations.
I'm wondering what made it a political issue. That's always baffled me. To me, I'm intrigued by the science of it all, and I can understand how maybe we're seeing a part of the cycle that was never included in recorded history before. So it looks new to us, but it's actually old hat, and we need to discover that too. But how did it become a political football?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. Actually,
I specialize in those.
This was a hot issue when I was in the biotechnology industry.
Mm-hmm.
some years ago, and there was a scientist out in California who came up with a theory that things were changing because of fluoro hydrocarbons, and actually DuPont picked up on this, and their patents were running out on Freon. And so, pretty soon everybody was going to have access to Freon. And that, of course, is several billion dollar industry for DuPont. And so one theory was that DuPont picked it up, turned it into a political issue, and said, we need to come up. Of course, in the laboratory, they had alternatives for the Freon 12 that was commonly used back then. They had alternatives in the laboratory. And so in order to get to force people to change over, they had to get government involvement. And so using the old Freon causes, you know, global warming, destroys the ozone layer, and is going to cause havoc with the Earth. And so now we've got an issue that needs a political solution, and, you know, here we go. So a lot of these things, you know, become political, I think, because there's big money behind it.
Dave, I said the word, or you said the word political, and David's eyes just lit up over there. And you wanted to get a word in edgewise, David. What was your thought?
Well, the have you read the Michael Crichton book, State of Fear?
No, I have not.
Don or Jim?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's a fictionalized account of and it's a deeper story, but it talks about a group of very entrepreneurial scientists who realized there's a lot of money to be made in this activity. And you know, I don't remember the particular scientific issue in the book, but what they do is they suggest to governments all over the world that unless we pay a huge amount of money to first research this particular subject and then spend a great deal of money stopping it, whatever it is, then the Earth is just going to burn up, freeze up, splinter in thousands of pieces. And the whole purpose is to keep this fiction alive as long as the money keeps flowing in.
You know, it's also cynical.
It's also another method of redistribution of wealth because, yeah. You know, America is made out to be the big polluter of the Earth when, you know, in fact, China's doing a very good job, and we don't hear, you know, anyone coming against China to say, hey, you got to stop, you know, pumping all those hydrocarbons into the atmosphere because it's warming up our Earth. I mean, yeah.
Now, Dr. Don, last week I remember asking the question, and I remember your answer clearly about when it is, at what point that the science, the quantity, the integrity of science tends to go downhill, and it's with the introduction of money. Whether it's applied science and research grants and corporations to get involved in proving a point to justify their existence, justify their products, or as you say, the DuPont company, you know, their position in perpetuating their financial well-being with the issue of Freon. Interesting point, I think. How do you guard against that, I guess, is the question. Are there pure scientists and applied scientists so that somebody can make the cause for pure science?
Yeah, there's plenty of scientists out there that have a pure motive and are just interested in figuring out, you know, how something works or doing, as we talked about last time, doing research that, you know, that benefits man as opposed to, you know, just for the love of money aspect of it. The scientist at the bench is not making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Overall, I mean, yeah, he's got a good salary, but he's not the one making the billions. It's the head of the corporations as you know, their stock, you know, goes up because they come out with a new product and that then drives the stock up. That, you know, if for example you have a new product that someone that most people need or use, you're going to you know, if you can corner the market, then you're certainly going to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. There's kind of a collateral issue to what we've been talking about. And again, it's the difference between science and faith, I guess, is the only word I can apply to it. Science has certain tools. They use test tubes and petri dishes and Bunsen burners and super colliders. And it's a matter of catalysts and energy and so forth. That's how they would make stuff or start the process of creation. God does it with his word. How does science look at that claim? I mean, is there a way to marry the two, to understand the two in the same sentence together?
Yeah, now you're getting into probably a fairly long discussion. But the science right now, I don't think really addresses the issue because they've put God outside the box. But myself, I've thought about this particular issue for a number of years, and what God says in His Word can be used to help us understand the world around us. And let me give you just a little bit of an example. We know that from Genesis 1, for example, that God, you know, created the heavens and the earth, and that the second verse is that, you know, His Spirit hovered over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Well, we are created to have speech. And we are made in the image of God, and we are created to have speech, mainly to communicate with one another. But our speech is a disturbance of the air, you know, around us, and causes sound waves, and our ears are designed to pick up the sound waves, so, and then translate those back into electrical impulses so that our brains can then interpret them as words.
And that's the science of how, to me.
That's the science of how.
Yeah.
Now, if we use the science of how to say, okay, let's step back from that and say, now we have God speaking. What does God speak into? I mean, the Word clearly says that God spoke.
So there must be a spiritual equivalent, but how do we connect the two? Where's the bridge here? It must be similar. We see patterns in all through Scripture of something that happens in this a spirit realm that has a parallel on Earth in a much smaller, less powerful sort of form.
Right.
And I know that it's man's mind is like an engine. You know, a motor converts one form of energy to another more useful form of energy. It's kind of like the mind is an engine that takes something spiritual, an idea, an inspiration, a notion, a hunch, and then makes it real by converting it into something physical. Somehow, God works in the physical because He's in all and through all, and I'm getting way in over my head here.
Well, let me step back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 3, when God said, "Let there be light."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have this dilemma. What does God speak into? And in order to make light, I mean, because that's the first question. If you look at the scripture there, that's the first question. How did God make light? Well, you know, you look and say, what is light? And I have really come down to the question that light is a disturbance in space-time.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, it's vibrations. We know that it has both particle and wave characteristics through quantum mechanics and quantum physics. And so if it has both wave characteristics, is it possible that the medium that God spoke into was actually space-time? So it's God's very voice that creates light. And then the next half of that verse says, God saw, you know, said, "Let there be light," and let the light be separated, you know, from the darkness. So He did something to separate light from the darkness. If He just spoke, then everything would be bright.
Mm-hmm.
You know, light would be everywhere in the space-time that He has created in the verse before, let's say. So when He says He separated the light from the darkness, is it possible that at that point in time He put a spin on light, on the light that He just spoke into existence? And once you put a spin on light, then you can now create all the subatomic particles. You can create electrons and you know, all the stuff that we see matter is today. Quantum physics would tell us that matter is nothing but vibrations. And so it goes quite well with what the scripture is saying. It is the very voice of God that created everything. And we see it as hard stuff. But if you keep looking deeper and deeper and deeper, the deeper you go, the less stuff is there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really a disturbance in space. So we can look at this and say that we are a disturbance in space. But at the same time, we can look at that and say, we are the very voice of God.
Interesting stuff, Wick. I want to continue this for the next 48 hours or so before I take a break. I'm just really into this now. I did a presentation at church in front of a class, and it was based upon something I saw, and I'm trying to remember where I saw it. It had to do with the electromagnetic spectrum. And the example was given to me, and I used it in class, that if we could picture the electromagnetic spectrum as a roll of a movie film that stretched from Seattle to San Diego, that the part of that spectrum that we can sense and that we function in would take up about 1 inch somewhere in the neighborhood of San Francisco. In other words, you've got the low end of the spectrum up at Seattle and the higher frequencies down in San Diego. And we're equipped to see such a small part of the entire spectrum, in which we know we can sense through instrumentation and other invention that there's activity there, there's energy, there's something going on there. But we can receive such a small part of it. It left me with a real feeling of wonder and really a convincing argument for God that there can be that much that we're just not equipped to receive. That's how much we don't know, I guess, is one way to put it.
Yeah, I guess as Socrates said, you know, the more he knows, the more he doesn't know. And a true scientist would say that. I mean, the more that he investigates, the more there is to investigate. And the problem just keeps, you know, getting bigger and bigger instead of getting tighter and tighter. So it's, you have to marvel at God's creation. I mean, because for me, for example, as a scientist and a person who likes to look at things and wonder why, you know, why or how, and you start to delve into that, it's just amazing. The more you get into it, that wow, you know, God really did create a world for us that it could take multiple lifetimes to ever figure this out, if we ever can.
Well, I suggest we continue working on it because it's fascinating, and I feel a little better off every time we talk to you here. David, as always, you get the last question here.
Hey, Don, one of the traditions of the show is that I get the zinger question. I get the one that just resounds in amazing clarity, and sometimes it actually does. One of the things you mentioned earlier about the changing theory of evolution, to expand, to accept new evidence, new criteria, new things that are discovered. And one of the things that I guess I've read about from other fields of science, is anybody working on a unified theory in this particular field? Some sort of a theory that would encompass all of the phenomena, or is it just kind of a piecemeal approach and people are just kind of trying to catch up? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I think I can I understand your question. A unified theory as far as evolution is concerned, I'm assuming that's what you mean.
Yeah, or if we, you know, and I don't know that we could call it evolution, but some sort of unified theory.
If you go to the physics, from the physical standpoint, a unified field theory has been the goal of physicists, you know, since Einstein, because Einstein was trying to wrap it all up into some neat equations, couldn't do it, and brilliant men, you know, since that time have been trying to wrap their hands around it as well. If we can put everything just into equation, that would be nice. I don't think God created it that way necessarily, although I don't think it's complicated, because God doesn't necessarily, you know, he is a very complex being, of course, but since evolution cannot be tested, it's not like the physical sciences, it's not like physics, for example, where you can have a hypothesis and test it, or come up with some mathematical formula and say, does this formula hold for this observation over here? Evolution, by its definition, takes a long period of time, and so it's very, very difficult to be able to say, well, I'm just going to come up with one theory and a unified theory. We're just going to wrap this all up and say this is it. Now, unfortunately, in school these days, they're saying evolution is a fact. But ask them what evolution they're talking about, they won't be able to necessarily define it.
Well, that brings up a wonderful point, and maybe we conclude with it, is that, that evolution itself is not science. Science is one of the tools used to uncover and analyze evidence in the theory of evolution, but it's not all about science. And I think maybe the more we can combine some of the non-scientific aspects of it, the clearer the picture will be. So I suggest that David and Dr. Don, the three of us get together again, if not next Monday, because I know, Don, you said you'd be traveling, maybe the following month, then we'll solve it then.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Great idea.
Dr. Don Clark joining us this morning from Grandview, Texas, and he is a part of the Creation Moments Ministry, sits on the board and contributes marvelously there and to many other ministries. In fact, I wanted to ask you, Don, what are some of the other ministries that you're involved in? I know there's a passel of them.
Yeah, well, I actually started off in ministry with an organization called Sharing International, and Sharing did two things. One is send out short-term teams, and the other is also radio broadcast training for folks in developing nations that need some assistance. So, you guys in the field might be interested in doing some training at some point in time, and I can put you in touch with Chuck Pollock, who is the the president of that organization, and he can put you to work.
Aha. Work?
Now you got my attention. Doing what?
For example, we've done a lot of work in Belize and trained pretty much everyone who started a radio station, a Christian radio station in Belize. Mm-hmm. And the first radio station was a Christian radio station. But Sharing has been involved with the development of radio in Belize for probably 20 years now. So that's one organization. Another organization is Orphan Relief and Rescue. And that I'm also on the board of that organization and help found that organization. We help orphans in Africa, primarily Liberia and Benin, West Africa. We have about 1,000 orphans that we're working with and about 22 orphanages, primarily about four. And we do everything from construction to child development programs to feeding programs to medical programs to just to, you know, help these orphans that have no other help, really.
Mm. Well, Don, it's a privilege to have you on the air with us, and you're making me feel lazy now. I'm not involved in enough things I can see right now. And we'll look forward to speaking with you again, Dr. Don Clark, with Creation Moments and many other organizations, as you've just heard. And Don, we'll look forward to our next conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
Derry Dougherty, Paul Coleman, Sarah Groves, and Glass Burr, Jesus Went to the Garden. Good morning to you from Broken Road Radio.